Chapter 10. As the cruiser with Tom Lund behind the wheel noses down 3rd Street to Chase, roof rack lights decorously dark, siren off, Dale takes out his wallet and begins digging through the mess in the back. Business cards people have given him, a few dog-eared photographs, little licks of folded-over notebook paper. On one of the latter, he finds what he wants. "What you doing, boss?" Tom asks. "None of your beeswax, just drive the car." Dale grabs the phone from its spot on the console, grimaces, and wipes off the residue of someone's powdered donut. Then, without much hope, dials the number of Jack Sawyer's cell phone. He starts to smile when the phone is answered on the 4th ring, but the smile metamorphoses into a frown of puzzlement. He knows that voice and should recognize it, but... "Hello," says the person who has apparently answered Jack's cell phone. "Speak now, whoever you are, or forever hold your peace." Then Dale knows. Would have known him immediately if he had been at home or in his office, but in this context... "Henry?" he says, knowing he sounds stupid but not able to help it. "Uncle Henry, is that you?" Jack is piloting his truck across the Tamarack Bridge when the cell phone in his pants pocket starts its annoying little tweet. He takes it out and taps the back of Henry's hand with it. "Deal with this," he says. "Cell phones give you brain cancer." "Which is okay for me, but not for you."
"More or less, yeah."
"That's what I love about you, Jack," Henry says, and opens the phone with a nonchalant flick of the wrist. "Hello?" And, after a pause, "Speak now, whoever you are, or forever hold your peace." Jack glances at him, then back at the road. They're coming up on Roy's store, where the early shopper gets the best greens. "Yes, Dale, it is indeed your esteemed..." Henry listens, frowning a little bit and smiling a little bit. "I'm in Jack's truck with Jack," he says. "George Rathbun isn't working this morning because KDCU is covering the summer marathon over in La Rive." He listens some more, then says, "If it's a Nokia, which is what it feels like and sounds like, then it's digital rather than analog." "Wait," he looks at Jack. "Your cell," he says, "it's a Nokia?" "Yes, but why?" "Because digital phones are supposedly harder to snoop," Henry says, and goes back to the phone. "It's a digital, and I'll put him on. I'm sure Jack can explain everything." Henry hands him the telephone, folds his hands primly in his lap, and looks out the window exactly as he would if surveying the scenery. And maybe he is, Jack thinks. Maybe in some weird fruit bat way he really is. He pulls over to the shoulder on Highway 93. He doesn't like the cell phone to begin with, 21st-century slave bracelets, he thinks them, but he absolutely loathes driving while talking on one. Besides, Irma Furneaux isn't going anywhere this morning. "Dale?" he says. "Where are you?" Dale asks, and Jack knows at once that the fisherman has been busy elsewhere, too. "As long as it's not another dead kid," he thinks. "Not that. Not yet, please. How come you're with Henry? Is Fred Marshall there, too?" Jack tells him about the change in plan and is about to go on when Dale breaks in. "Whatever you're doing, I want you to get your ass out to a place called Ed's Eats and Dogs near Goltz's. Henry can help you find it. The fisherman called the station, Jack. He called 911, told us Irma Furneaux's body is out there. Well, not in so many words, but he did say she." Dale is not quite babbling, but almost. Jack notes this as any good clinician would note the symptoms of a patient. "I need you, Jack. That's where we were headed anyway," Jack says quietly, although they are going absolutely nowhere at this moment, just sitting on the shoulder while the occasional car blips past on 93. "What?" Hoping that Dale and Henry are right about the virtues of digital technology, Jack tells French Landing's police chief about his morning delivery, aware that Henry, although still looking out the window, is listening sharply. He tells Dale that Ty Marshall's cap was on top of the box with the feathers and Irma's foot inside it. "Holy," Dale says, sounding out of breath. "Holy shit." "Tell me what you've done," Jack says, and Dale does. It sounds pretty good, so far at least. But Jack doesn't like the part about Arnold Hrabowski. The mad Hungarian has impressed him as the sort of fellow who will never be able to behave like a real cop, no matter how hard he tries. Back in L.A., they used to call the Arnie Hrabowskis of the world Mayberry RFDs. "Dale, what about the phone at the 7-Eleven?" "It's a payphone," Dale says, as if speaking to a child. Yes, but there could be fingerprints, Jack says. I mean, there are going to be billions of fingerprints, but forensics can isolate the freshest, easily. He might have worn gloves, but maybe not. If he's leaving messages and calling cards as well as writing to the parents, he's gone stage two. Killing isn't enough for him anymore. He wants to play you now, play with you. Maybe he even wants to be caught and stopped like Son of Sam. The phone. Fresh fingerprints on the phone. Dale sounds badly humiliated, and Jack's heart goes out to him. Jack, I can't do this. I'm lost. This is something to which Jack chooses not to speak. Instead, he says, who've you got who can see to the phone? Dit Jesperson and Bobby Dulac, I guess. Bobby, Jack thinks, is entirely too good to waste for long at the 7-Eleven outside town. Just have them crisscross the phone with yellow tape and talk to the guy on duty. Then they can come on out to the site. Okay. Dale hesitates, then asks a question. The defeat in it, the sense of almost complete abrogation, makes Jack sad. Anything else? Have you called the state police, county? Does that FBI guy know, the one who thinks he looks like Tommy Lee Jones? Dale snorts. Actually, I decided to sit on notification for a little while. Good, Jack says. And the savage satisfaction in his voice causes Henry to turn from his blind regard of the countryside and regard his friend instead, eyebrows raised. Let us rise up again, on wings as eagles, as the Reverend Lance Hovdahl, French Landing's Lutheran pastor, might say, and fly down the black ribbon of Highway 93, back toward town. We reach Route 35 and turn right. Closer and to our right is the overgrown lane that leads not to a dragon's hidden gold or secret dwarf mines, but to that peculiarly unpleasant black house. A little farther on, we can see the futuristic dome shape of Goltz's. Well, it seemed futuristic in the 70s, at least. All our landmarks are in place, including the rubbly, weedy path that shoots off from the main road to the left. This is the track that leads to the remains of Ed Gilbertson's erstwhile Palace of Guilty Pleasures. Let us flutter onto the telephone line just across from this track. Hot gossip tickles our birdie feet. Paula Hrabowski's friend Myrtle Harrington passing on the news of the dead body, or bodies, at Ed's to Richie Bumstead, who will in turn pass it on to Beezer St. Pierre, grieving father and spiritual leader of the Thunder Five. This passage of voices through the wire probably shouldn't please us, but it does. Gossip is no doubt nasty stuff, but it does energize the human spirit. Now, from the west comes the cruiser with Tom Lund at the wheel and Dale Gilbertson in the shotgun seat. And from the east comes Jack's burgundy-colored Ram pickup. They reach the turnoff to Ed's at the same time. Jack motions for Dale to go first, then follows him. We take wing, fly above and then ahead of them. We roost on the rusty Esso gas pump to watch developments. Jack drives slowly down the lane to the half-collapsed building that stands in a scruff of high weeds and goldenrod. He's looking for any sign of passage, and sees only the fresh tracks made by Dale and Tom's police car. We've got the place to ourselves, he informs Henry. Yes, but for how long? Not very, would have been Jack's answer had he bothered to give one. Instead, he pulls up next to Dale's car and gets out. Henry rolls down his window but stays put as ordered. Ed's was once a simple wooden building about the length of a Burlington Northern boxcar and with a boxcar's flat roof. At the south end, you could buy soft-serve ice cream from one of three windows. At the north end, you could get your nasty hot dog or your even nastier order of fish and chips to go. In the middle was a small sit-down restaurant featuring a counter and red-top stools. Now the south end has entirely collapsed, probably from the weight of snow. All the windows have been broken in. There's some graffiti, so-and-so chugs cock, we fucked Patty Jarvis until she howled, Troy loves Marianne, but not as much as Jack might have expected. All but one of the stools have been looted. Crickets are conversing in the grass. They're loud, but not as loud as the flies inside the ruined restaurant. There are lots of flies in there. Regular fly convention in progress. And, do you smell it? Dale asks him. Jack nods. Of course he does. He smelled it already today, but now it's worse. Because there's more of Irma out here to send up a stink, much more than what would fit into a single shoebox. Tom Lund has produced a handkerchief and is mopping his broad, distressed face. It's warm, but not warm enough to account for the sweat streaming off his face and brow, and his skin is pasty. Officer Lund, Jack says. Huh? Tom jumps and looks rather wildly around at Jack. You may have to vomit. If you feel you must, do it over there. Jack points to an overgrown track, even more ancient and ill-defined than the one leading in from the main road. This one seems to meander in the direction of Goltz's.
I'll be okay, Tom says.
I know you will. But if you need to unload, don't do it on what may turn out to be evidence. I want you to start stringing yellow tape around the entire building, Dale tells his officer. Jack, a word? Dale puts a hand on Jack's forearm and starts walking back toward the truck. Although he's got a good many things on his mind, Jack notices how strong that hand is, and no tremble in it. Not yet, anyway. What is it? Jack asks impatiently when they're standing near the passenger window of the truck. We want to look before the whole world gets here, don't we? Wasn't that the idea, or am I? You need to get the foot, Jack, Dale says. And then, hello, Uncle Henry, you look spiff. Thanks, Henry says. What are you talking about, Jack asks. That foot is evidence. Dale nods. I think it ought to be evidence found here, though, unless, of course, you relish the idea of spending 24 hours or so answering questions in Madison. Jack opens his mouth to tell Dale not to waste what little time they have with errant idiocies, then closes it again. It suddenly occurs to him how his possession of that foot might look to minor league smarties like Detectives Brown and Black, maybe even to a major league smartie like John Redding of the FBI. Brilliant cop retires at an impossibly young age and to the impossibly bucolic town of French Landing, Wisconsin. He has plenty of scratch, but the source of income is blurry, to say the least. And oh, look at this. All at once there's a serial killer operating in the neighborhood. Maybe the brilliant cop has got a loose screw. Maybe he's like those firemen who enjoy the pretty flame so much they get into the arson game themselves. Certainly Dale's color posse would have to wonder why the fisherman would send an early retiree like Jack a victim's body part. And the hat, Jack thinks. Don't forget Ty's baseball cap. All at once he knows how Dale felt when Jack told him that the phone at the 7-Eleven had to be cordoned off. Exactly. Oh, man, he says, you're right. He looks at Tom Lund, industriously running yellow police line tape, while butterflies dance around his shoulders and the flies continue their drunken buzzing from the shadows of Ed's Eats. What about him? Tom will keep his mouth shut, Dale says, and on that Jack decides to trust him. He wouldn't had it been the Hungarian. I owe you one, Jack says. Yep, Henry agrees from his place in the passenger seat. Even a blind man could see he owes you one. Shut up, Uncle Henry, Dale says. Yes, mon capitaine. What about the cap? Jack asks. If we find anything else of Ty Marshall's, Dale pauses, then swallows, or Ty himself, we'll leave it. If not, you keep it for the time being. I think maybe you just saved me a lot of major irritation, Jack says, leading Dale to the back of the truck. He opens the stainless steel box behind the cab, which he hasn't bothered to lock for the run out here, and takes out one of the trash can liners. From inside it comes the slosh of water and the clink of a few remaining ice cubes. The next time you get feeling dumb, you might remind yourself of that. Dale ignores this completely. Oh, God, he says, making it one word. He's looking at the baggie that has just emerged from the trash can liner. There are beads of water clinging to the transparent sides. The smell of it, Henry says with undeniable distress. Oh, the poor child. You can smell it even through the plastic? Jack asks. Yes, indeed, and coming from there. Henry points at the ruined restaurant and then produces his cigarettes. If I'd known, I would have brought a jar of Vicks and an El Producto. In any case, there's no need to walk the baggie with the gruesome artifact inside it past Tom Lund, who has now disappeared behind the ruins with his reel of yellow tape. "Go on in," Dale instructs Jack quietly. "Get a look and take care of the thing in that baggie if you find, you know, her. I want to speak to Tom." Jack steps through the warped, doorless doorway into the thickening stench. Outside, he can hear Dale instructing Tom to send Pam Stevens and Danny Cheetah back down to the end of the access road as soon as they arrive, where they will serve as passport control. The interior of Ed's Eats will probably be bright by afternoon, but now it is shadowy, lit mostly by crazed, crisscrossing rays of sun. Galaxies of dust spin lazily through them. Jack steps carefully, wishing he had a flashlight, not wanting to go back and get one from the cruiser until he's taken care of the foot. He thinks of this as redeployment. There are human tracks through the dust, trash, and drifts of old gray feathers. The tracks are man-sized. Weaving in and out of them are a dog's paw prints. Off to his left, Jack spies a neat little pile of droppings. He steps around the rusty remains of an overturned gas grill and follows both sets of tracks around the filthy counter. Outside, the second French landing cruiser is rolling up. And here, in this darker world, the sound of the flies has become a soft roar, and the stench... the stench. Jack fishes a handkerchief from his pocket and places it over his nose as he follows the tracks into the kitchen. Here the paw prints multiply, and the human footprints disappear completely. Jack thinks grimly of the circle of beaten-down grass he made in the field of that other world, a circle with no path of beaten-down grass leading to it. Lying against the far wall near a pool of dried blood is what remains of Irma Furneaux. The mop of her filthy, strawberry-blonde hair mercifully obscures her face. Above her, on a rusty piece of tin that probably once served as a heat shield for the deep-fat fryers, two words have been written with what Jack feels sure was a black Sharpie marker. "Hello, boys." "Ah, fuck!" Dale Gilbertson says from almost directly behind him, and Jack nearly screams. Outside, the snafu starts almost immediately. Halfway back down the access road, Danny and Pam, not in the least bit disappointed to have been assigned guard duty once they have actually seen the slumped ruin of Ed's and smelled the aroma drifting from it, nearly have a head-on with an old International Harvester pickup that is bucketing toward Ed's at a good 40 miles an hour. Luckily, Pam swings the cruiser to the right, and the driver of the pickup, Teddy Runkleman, swings left. The vehicles miss each other by inches and swerve into the grass on either side of this poor excuse for a road. The pickup's rusty bumper thumps against a small birch. Pam and Danny get out of their unit, hearts pumping, adrenaline spurting. Four men come spilling out of the pickup's cab like clowns out of the little car in the circus. Mrs. Morton would recognize them all as regulars at Roy's store. Layabouts, she would call them.
"What in the name of God are you doing?"
Danny Cheetah roars. His hand drops to the butt of his gun and then falls away a bit reluctantly. He's getting a headache. The men, Runkleman is the only one the officers know by name, although between them they recognize the faces of the other three, are goggle-eyed with excitement.
"How many did you find?"
one of them spits. Pam can actually see the spittle spraying out in the morning air, a sight she could have done without.
"How many did the bastard kill?"
Pam and Danny exchange a single dismayed look. And before they can reply, holy God, here comes an old Chevrolet Bel Air with another four or five men inside it. No, one of them is a woman. They pull up and spill out, also like clowns from the little car. But we're the real clowns, Pam thinks. Us. Pam and Danny are surrounded by eight semi-hysterical men and one semi-hysterical woman, all of them throwing questions.
"Hell, I'm going up there and see for myself,"
Teddy Runkleman shouts, almost jubilantly, and Danny realizes the situation is on the verge of spinning out of control. If these fools get the rest of the way up the access road, Dale will first tear him a new asshole and then salt it down.
"Hold it right there, all of you," he bawls
and actually draws his gun. It's a first for him, and he hates the weight of it in his hand. These are ordinary people, after all, not bad guys. But it gets their attention. This is a crime scene, Pam says, finally able to speak in a normal tone of voice. They mutter and look at one another, worst fears confirmed. She steps to the driver of the Chevrolet.
Who are you, sir? A Sacknessum? You look like a Sacknessum.
Freddy, he admits.
Well, you get back in your vehicle, Freddy Sacknessum, and the rest of you who came with him also get in, and you back the hell right out of here. Don't bother trying to turn around, you'll just get stuck.
But, the woman begins, Pam thinks she's a Sanger, a clan of fools if there ever was one.
Stow it and go, Pam tells her.
And you right behind him,
Danny tells Teddy Runkleman. He just hopes to Christ no more will come along, or they'll end up trying to manage a parade in reverse. He doesn't know how the news got out, and at this moment can't afford to care. Unless you want a summons for interfering with a police investigation, that can get you 5 years. He has no idea if there is such a charge, but it gets them moving even better than the sight of his pistol. The Chevrolet backs out, rear end wagging from side to side like a dog's tail. Runkleman's pickup goes next, with two of the men standing up and back and peering over the cab, trying to catch sight of the old restaurant's roof, at least. Their curiosity lends them a look of unpleasant vacuity. The PD unit comes last, herding the old car and older truck like a corgi herding sheep, roof rack lights now pulsing. Pam is forced to ride mostly on the brake, and as she drives, she lets loose a low-pitched stream of words her mother never taught her.
"Do you kiss your kids goodnight with that mouth?"
Danny asks, not without admiration.
"Shut up," she says then. "You got any aspirin?"
"I was going to ask you the same thing," Danny says.
They get back out to the main road just in time. Three more vehicles are coming from the direction of French Landing, two from the direction of Centralia and Arden. A siren rises in the warming air. Another cruiser, the third in what was supposed to be an unobtrusive line, is coming along, passing the looky-loos from town.
"Oh, man," Danny sounds close to tears. "Oh, man, oh, man, oh, man, it's going to be a carnival, and I bet the stadies still don't know. They'll have kittens. Dale is going to have kittens."
"It'll be all right," Pam says. "Calm down. We'll just pull across the road and park. Also, stick your gun back in the fucking holster."
"Yes, mother."
He stows his piece as Pam swings across the access road, pulling back to let the third cruiser through, then pulling forward again to block the way.
"Yeah, maybe we caught it in time to put a lid on it."
"Of course we did."
They relax a little. Both of them have forgotten the old stretch of road that runs between Ed's and Gultz's, but there are plenty of folks in town who know about it. Beezer St. Pierre and his boys, for instance. And while Wendell Green does not, guys like him always seem to be able to find the back way. They've got an instinct for it. Chapter 11. Beezer's journey began with Myrtle Harrington, the loving wife of Michael Harrington, whispering down the telephone line to Richie Bumstead, on whom she has an industrial-strength crush, in spite of his having been married to her second-best friend, Glad, who dropped down dead in her kitchen at the amazing age of 31. For his part, Richie Bumstead has had enough macaroni tuna casseroles and whisper-voiced phone calls from Myrtle to last him through two more lifetimes, but this is one set of whispers he's glad, even oddly relieved, to listen to, because he drives a truck for the Kingsland Brewing Company and has come to know Beezer St. Pierre and the rest of the boys at least a little bit. At first, Richie thought the Thunder Five was a bunch of hoodlums, those big guys with scraggly shoulder-length hair and foaming beards roaring through town on their Harleys, but one Friday he happened to be standing alongside the one called Mouse in the pay window line, and Mouse looked down at him and said something funny about how working for love never made the paycheck look bigger, and they got into a conversation that made Richie Bumstead's head spin. Two nights later, he saw Beezer St. Pierre and the one called Doc shooting the breeze in the yard when he came off shift, and after he got his rig locked down for the night, he went over and got into another conversation that made him feel like he'd walked into a combination of a raunchy blues bar and a Jeopardy championship. These guys, Beezer, Mouse, Doc, Sonny, and Kaiser Bill, looked like rockin', stompin', red-eyed violence, but they were smart. Beezer, it turned out, was head brewmaster in Kingsland Ale's Special Projects Division, and the other guys were just under him. They had all gone to college. They were interested in making great beer and having a good time. And Richie sort of wished he could get a bike and let it all hang out like them.
But a long Saturday afternoon and evening at the sand bar proved that the line between a high old time and utter abandon was too fine for him. He didn't have the stamina to put away two pitchers of Kingsland, play a decent game of pool, drink two more pitchers while talking about the influences of Sherwood Anderson and Gertrude Stein on the young Hemingway, get into some serious headbutting, put down another couple of pitchers, emerge clear-headed enough to go barrel-assing through the countryside, pick up a couple of experimental Madison girls, smoke a lot of high-grade shit, and romp until dawn. You have to respect people who can do that and still hold down good jobs. As far as Richie is concerned, he has a duty to tell Beezer that the police have finally learned the whereabouts of Irma Freneau's body. That busybody Myrtle said it was a secret Richie has to keep to himself, but he's pretty sure that right after Myrtle gave him the news, she called four or five other people. Those people will call their best friends, and in no time at all, half of French Landing is going to be heading over on 35 to be in on the action. Beezer has a better right to be there than most, doesn't he? Less than 30 seconds after getting rid of Myrtle Harrington, Richie Bumstead looks up Beezer St. Pierre in the directory and dials the number.
"Richie, I sure hope you aren't shitting me," Beezer says. "You called in, yeah?"
Beezer wants Richie to repeat it.
"That worthless piece of shit in the dare car, the mad Hungarian, and he said the girl was where?" "Fuck, the whole town is going to be out there," Beezer says. "But thanks, man, thanks a lot, I owe you."
In the instant before the receiver slams down, Richie thinks he hears Beezer start to say something else that gets dissolved in a scalding rush of emotion. And in the little house on Nail House Row, Beezer St. Pierre swipes tears into his beard, gently moves the telephone a few inches back on the table, and turns to face Bear Girl, his common-law spouse, his old lady, Amy's mother, whose real name is Susan Osgood, and who is staring up at him from beneath her thick, blonde bangs, one finger holding her place in a book.
"It's the Freneau girl," he says. "I gotta go."
"Go," Bear Girl tells him. "Take the cell phone and call me as soon as you can."
"Yeah," he says, and plucks the cell phone from its charger and rams it into a front pocket of his jeans.
Instead of moving to the door, he thrusts a hand into the huge red-brown tangle of his beard and absent-mindedly combs it with his fingers. His feet are rooted to the floor. His eyes have lost focus.
"The fisherman called 911, he says. "Can you believe this shit? They couldn't find the Freneau girl by themselves. They needed him to tell them where to find her body."
"Listen to me," Bear Girl says, and gets up and travels the space between them far more quickly than she seems to. She snuggles her compact little body into his massive bulk, and Beezer inhales a chestful of her clean, soothing scent, a combination of soap and fresh bread. "When you and the boys get out there, it's going to be up to you to keep them in line. So you have to keep yourself in line, Beezer. No matter how angry you are, you can't go nuts and start beating on people, cops especially."
"I suppose you think I shouldn't go."
"You have to. I just don't want you to wind up in jail."
"Hey," he says, "I'm a brewer, not a brawler."
"Don't forget it," she says, and pats him on the back. "Are you going to call them?"
"Street telephone."
Beezer walks to the door, bends down to pick up his helmet, and marches out. Sweat slides down his forehead and crawls through his beard. Two strides bring him to his motorcycle. He puts one hand on the saddle, wipes his forehead, and bellows,
"The fucking fisherman told that fucking Hungarian cop where to find Irma Freneau's body. Who's coming with me?"
On both sides of Nail House Row, bearded heads pop out of windows and loud voices shout,
"Wait up! Holy shit! And yo!"
Four vast men in leather jackets, jeans, and boots come barreling out of four front doors. Beezer almost has to smile. He loves these guys, but sometimes they remind him of cartoon characters. Even before they reach him, he starts explaining about Richie Bumstead and the 911 call, and by the time he finishes, Mouse, Doc, Sonny, and Kaiser Bill are on their bikes and waiting for the signal.
"But this here's the deal," Beezer says. "Two things. We're going out there for Amy and Irma Freneau and Johnny Erkenham, not for ourselves. We want to make sure everything gets done the right way, and we're not going to bust anybody's head open, not unless they ask for it. You got that?"
The others rumble, mumble, and grumble, apparently in assent. Four tangled beards wag up and down. And number two, when we do bust open somebody's head, it's going to be the fishermen's, because we have put up with enough crap around here, and now I am pretty damn sure it's our turn to hunt down the fucking bastard who killed my little girl.
Beezer's voice catches in his throat, and he raises his fist before continuing.
And dump this other little girl in that fucking shack out on 35, because I am going to get my hands on that fucking fuckhead, and when I do, I am going to get righteous on his ass.
His boys, his crew, his posse shake their fists in the air and bellow. Five motorcycles surge noisily into life.
"Well, take a look at the place from the highway and double back to the road behind Goltz's," Beezer shouts, and charges down the road and uphill on Chase Street with the others in his slipstream.
Through the middle of town they roll, Beezer in the lead, Mouse and Sonny practically on his tailpipe, Doc and the Kaiser right behind, their beards flowing in the wind. The thunder of their bikes rattles the windows in Schmidt's all sorts and sends starlings flapping up from the marquee of the Agincourt Theater. Hanging over the bars of his Harley, Beezer looks a little bit like King Kong getting set to rip apart a jungle gym. Once they get past the 7-Eleven, Kaiser and Doc move up alongside Sonny and Mouse and take up the entire width of the highway. People driving west on 35 look at the figures charging toward them and swerve onto the shoulder. Drivers who see them in their rearview mirrors drift to the side of the road, stick their arms out of their windows, and wave them on. As they near Centralia, Beezer passes about twice as many cars as really ought to be traveling down a country highway on a weekend morning. The situation is even worse than he figured it would be. Dale Gilbertson is bound to have a couple of cops blocking traffic turning in from 35, but two cops couldn't handle more than 10 or 12 ghouls dead set on seeing, really seeing, the fisherman's handiwork. French Landing doesn't have enough cops to keep a lid on all the screwballs homing in on Ed's Eats. Beezer curses, picturing himself losing control, turning a bunch of twisted fisherman geeks into tent pegs. Losing control is exactly what he cannot afford to do, not if he expects any cooperation from Dale Gilbertson and his flunkies. Beezer leads his companions around a crapped-out old red Toyota and is visited by an idea so perfect that he forgets to strike unreasoning terror into the beater's driver by looking him in the eye and snarling, "I make Kingsland Ale the best beer in the world, you dimwit cur!" He has done this to two drivers this morning, and neither one let him down. The people who earn this treatment by either lousy driving or the possession of a truly ugly vehicle imagine that he is threatening them with some grotesque form of sexual assault, and they freeze like rabbits. They stiffen right up. Jolly good fun, as the citizens of Emerald City sang in The Wizard of Oz. The idea that has distracted Beezer from his harmless pleasures possesses the simplicity of most valid inspirations. The best way to get cooperation is to give it. He knows exactly how to soften up Dale Gilbertson. The answer is putting on a baseball cap, grabbing its car keys, and heading out the door. The answer lies all around him. One small part of that answer sits behind the wheel of the red Toyota just being overtaken by Beezer and his jolly crew. Wendell Green earned the mock rebuke he failed to receive on both of the conventional grounds. His little car may not have been ugly to begin with, but by now it is so disfigured by multiple dents and scrapes that it resembles a rolling sneer. And Green drives with an unyielding arrogance he thinks of as dash. He zooms through yellow lights, changes lanes recklessly, and tailgates as a means of intimidation. Of course, he blasts his horn at the slightest provocation. Wendell is a menace. The way he handles his car perfectly expresses his character, being inconsiderate, thoughtless, and riddled with grandiosity. At the moment, he is driving even worse than usual, because as he tries to overtake every other vehicle on the road, most of his concentration is focused on the pocket tape recorder he holds up to his mouth and the golden words his equally golden voice pours into the precious machine. Wendell often regrets the short-sightedness of the local radio stations in devoting so much airtime to fools like George Rathbun and Henry Shake when they could move up to a new level simply by letting him give an ongoing commentary on the news for an hour or so every day. Ah, the delicious combination of Wendell's words and Wendell's voice. Edward R. Murrow in his heyday never sounded so eloquent, so resonant. Here is what he is saying.
This morning, I joined a virtual caravan of the shocked, the grieving, and the merely curious in a mournful pilgrimage winding eastward along bucolic Highway 35. Not for the first time, this journalist was struck, and struck deeply, by the immense contrast between the loveliness and peace of the coulee country's landscape and the ugliness and savagery one deranged human being has wrought in its unsuspecting bosom. New paragraph. The news had spread like wildfire. Neighbor called neighbor, friend called friend. According to a morning 911 call to the French Landing police station, the mutilated body of little Irma Freneau lies within the ruins of a former ice cream parlor and cafe called Ed's Eats and Dogs. And who had placed the call? Surely some dutiful citizen. Not at all, ladies and gentlemen, not at all. Ladies and gentlemen, this is frontline reportage. This is the news being written while it happens, a concept that cannot but murmur Pulitzer Prize to an experienced journalist. The scoop had come to Wendell Green by way of his barber, Roy Royal, who heard it from his wife, Tilly Royal, who had been clued in by Myrtle Harrington herself. And Wendell Green has done his duty to his readers. He grabbed his tape recorder and his camera and ran out to his nasty little vehicle without pausing to telephone his editors at the Herald. He doesn't need a photographer. He can take all the photographs he needs with that dependable old Nikon F2A on the passenger seat. A seamless blend of words and pictures, a penetrating examination of the new century's most hideous crime, a thoughtful exploration into the nature of evil, a compassionate portrayal of one community's suffering, an unsparing exposé of one police department's ineptitude. With all this going on in his mind as his mellifluous words drip one by one into the microphone of his upheld cassette recorder, is it any wonder that Wendell Green fails to hear the sound of motorcycles or to take in the presence of the Thunder Five in any way until he happens to glance sideways in search of the perfect phrase? Glance sideways he does, and with a spurt of panic observes no more than 2 feet to his left, Beezer St. Pierre astride his roaring Harley, apparently singing, to judge from his own moving lips. Singing? Huh? Can't be. Nope. In Wendell's experience, Beezer St. Pierre is far more likely to be cursing like a navvy in a waterfront brawl. When, after the death of Amy St. Pierre, Wendell, who was merely obeying the ancient rules of his trade, dropped in at One Nail House Row and inquired of the grieving father how it felt to know that his daughter had been slaughtered like a pig and partially eaten by a monster in human form, Beezer had gripped the innocent newshound by the throat, unleashed a torrent of obscenities, and concluded by bellowing that if he should ever see Mr. Green again, he would tear off his head and use the stump as a sexual orifice. It is this threat that causes Wendell's moment of panic. He glances into his rearview mirror and sees Beezer's cohort strung across the road like an invading army of Goths. In his imagination, they are waving skulls on ropes made of human skin and yelling about what they're going to do to his neck after they rip his head off. Whatever he was about to dictate into the invaluable machine instantly evaporates, along with his daydreams of winning the Pulitzer Prize. His stomach clenches and sweat bursts from every pore on his broad, ruddy face. His left hand trembles on the wheel, his right shakes the cassette recorder like a castanet. Wendell lifts his foot from the accelerator and slides down on the car seat, turning his head as far to the right as he dares. His basic desire is to curl up in the well beneath the dashboard and pretend to be a fetus. The huge roar of sound behind him grows louder, and his heart leaps in his chest like a fish. Wendell whimpers. A rank of kettle drums batters the air beyond the fragile skin of the car door. Then the motorcycles swoop past him and race off up the highway. Wendell Green wipes his face. Slowly he persuades his body to sit up straight. His heart ceases its attempt to escape his chest. The world on the other side of his windshield, which had contracted to the size of a housefly, expands back to its normal size. It occurs to Wendell that he was no more afraid than any normal human being would be under the circumstances. Self-regard fills him like helium fills a balloon. Most guys he knows would have driven right off the road, he thinks. Most guys would have crapped in their pants. What did Wendell Green do? He slowed down a little, that's all. He acted like a gentleman and let the assholes of the Thunder Five drive past him. When it comes to Beezer and his apes, Wendell thinks, being a gentleman is the better part of valor. He picks up speed, watching the bikers race on ahead. In his hand, the cassette recorder is still running. Wendell raises it to his mouth, licks his lips, and discovers that he has forgotten what he was going to say. Blank tape whirls from spool to spool. "Damn," he says, and pushes the off button. An inspired phrase, a melodious cadence, has vanished into the ether, perhaps for good. But the situation is far more frustrating than that. It seems to Wendell that a whole series of logical connections has vanished with the lost phrase. He can remember seeing the shape of a vast outline for at least half a dozen penetrating articles that would go beyond the fisherman to... do what? Win him the Pulitzer, for sure, but how? The area in his mind that had given him the immense outline still holds its shape, but the shape is empty. Beezer, St. Pierre, and his goons murdered what now seems the greatest idea Wendell Green ever had, and Wendell has no certainty that he can bring it back to life. What are these biker freaks doing out here anyhow? The question answers itself. Some creepy do-gooder thought Beezer ought to know about the fisherman's 911 call, and now the biker freaks are headed to the ruins of Ed's just like him. Fortunately, so many other people are going to the same place that Wendell figures he can steer clear of his nemesis. Taking no chances, he drops a couple of cars behind the bikers. The traffic thickens and slows down. Up ahead, the bikers form a single line and zoom up alongside the line, crawling toward the dusty old lane to Ed's place. From 70 or 80 yards back, Wendell can see two cops, a man and a woman, trying to wave the rubberneckers along. Every time a fresh car pulls up in front of them, they have to go through the same pantomime of turning its occupants away and pointing down the road. To reinforce the message, a police car is parked sideways across the lane, blocking anyone who should try to get fancy. This spectacle troubles Wendell not at all, for the press has automatic access to such scenes. Journalists are the medium, the aperture, through which otherwise prohibited places and events reach the general public. Wendell Green is the people's representative here, and the most distinguished journalist in western Wisconsin, besides. After he has inched along another 30 feet, he sees that the cops riding herd on the traffic are Danny Cheetah and Pam Stevens, and his complacency wavers. A couple of days ago, both Cheetah and Stevens had responded to his request for information by telling him to go to hell. Pam Stevens is a know-it-all bitch anyhow, a professional ball-breaker. Why else would a reasonably okay-looking dame want to be a cop? Stevens would turn him away from the scene for the sheer hell of it. She'd enjoy it. Probably, Wendell realizes, he will have to sneak in somehow. He pictures himself crawling through the fields on his belly and shivers with distaste. At least he can have the pleasure of watching the cops giving the finger to Beezer and crew. The bikers roar past another half-dozen cars without slowing down, so Wendell supposes they plan on going into a flashy, skidding turn, dodging right by those two dumbbells in blue, and zooming around the patrol car as if it didn't exist. What will the cops do then, Wendell wonders? Drag out their guns and try to look fierce? Fire warning shots and hit each other in the foot? Astonishingly, Beezer and his train of fellow bikers pay no attention to the cars attempting to move into the lane, to Cheetah and Stevens, or to anything else up there. They do not even turn their heads to gape up at the ruined shack, the chief's car, the pickup truck, which Wendell instantly recognizes, and the men standing on the beaten grass, two of whom are Dale Gilbertson and the pickup's owner, Hollywood Jack Sawyer, that snooty L.A. prick. The third guy, who is wearing an ice cream hat, sunglasses, and a spiffy vest, makes no sense at all, at least not to Wendell. He looks like he dropped in from some old Humphrey Bogart movie. No, they blast on by the whole messy scene with their helmets pointed straight ahead, as if all they have in mind is cruising into Centralia and busting up the fixtures in the sandbar. On they go, all five of the bastards, indifferent as a pack of wild dogs. As soon as they hit the open road again, the other four move into parallel formation behind Beezer and fan out across the highway. Then, as one, they veer off to the left, send up five great plumes of dust and gravel, and spin into five U-turns. Without breaking stride, without even appearing to slow down, They separate into their 1-2-2 pattern and come streaking back westward toward the crime scene and French Landing.
I'll be damned, Wendell thinks. Beezer turned tail and gave up. What a wimp.
The knot of bikers grows larger and larger as it swoops toward him, and soon the amazed Wendell Green makes out Beezer St. Pierre's grim face, which beneath its helmet also gets larger and larger as it approaches.
I never figured you for a quitter, Wendell says, watching Beezer loom ever nearer.
The wind has parted his beard into two equal sections that flare out behind him on both sides of his head. Behind his goggles, Beezer's eyes look as if he is aiming down the barrel of a rifle. The thought that Beezer might turn those hunter's eyes on him makes Wendell's bowels feel dangerously loose.
Loser, he says, not very loudly. With an ear-pounding roar, Beezer flashes past the dented Toyota.
The rest of the Thunder Five hammer the air, then streak down the road. This evidence of Beezer's cowardice brightens Wendell's heart as he watches the bikers diminish in his rearview mirror. But a thought he cannot ignore begins to worm its way upward through the synapses of his brain. Wendell may not be the Edward R. Murrow of the present day, but he has been a reporter for nearly 30 years, and he has developed a few instincts. The thought winding through his mental channel sets off a series of wave-like alarms that at last push it into consciousness. Wendell gets it. He sees the hidden design. He understands what's going down.
Well, hot doggy, he says, and with a wide grin blasts his horn, cranks his wheel to the left, and jolts into a turn with only minimal damage to his fender and that of the car in front of him.
You sneaky bastard, he says, nearly chuckling with delight. The Toyota squeezes out of the line of vehicles pointed eastward and drifts over into the westbound lanes. Clanking and farting, it shoots away in pursuit of the crafty bikers. There will be no crawling through cornfields for Wendell Green. That sneaky bastard Beezer St. Pierre knows a back way to Ed's Eats. All our star reporter has to do is hang back far enough to stay out of sight, and he gets a free pass into the scene. Beautiful. Ah, the irony. Beezer gives the press a helpful hand. Many thanks, you arrogant thug. Wendell hardly supposes that Dale Gilbertson will give him the run of the place, but it will be harder to throw him out than to turn him away. In the time he has, he can ask a few probing questions, snap a few telling photos, and, above all, soak up enough atmosphere to produce one of his legendary color pieces. With a cheerful heart, Wendell poodles down the highway at 50 miles per hour, letting the bikers race far ahead of him without ever letting them pass out of sight. The number of cars coming to him thins out to widely spaced groups of two and three, then to a few single cars, then to nothing. As if they have been waiting to be unobserved, Beezer and his friends swerve across the highway and go blasting up the driveway to Goltz's space-age dome. Wendell feels an unwelcome trickle of self-doubt, but he is not about to assume that Beezer and his louts have a sudden yearning for tractor hitches and riding lawnmowers. He speeds up, wondering if they have spotted him and are trying to throw him off their trail. As far as he knows, there is nothing up on that rise except the showroom, the maintenance garage, and the parking lot. Damn place looks like a wasteland. Beyond the parking lot? What? On one side, he remembers a scrubby field stretching away to the horizon. On the other, a bunch of trees, like a forest, only not as thick. He can see the trees from where he is now, running downhill like a windbreak. Without bothering to signal, he speeds across the incoming lanes and into Goltz's driveway. The sound of the motorcycles is still audible but growing softer, and Wendell experiences a jolt of fear that they have somehow tricked him and are getting away, jeering at him. At the top of the rise, he zooms around the front of the showroom and drives into the big lot. Two huge yellow tractors stand in front of the equipment garage, but his is the only car in sight. At the far end of the empty lot, a low concrete wall rises to bumper height between the asphalt and the meadow bordered by trees. On the other side of the tree line, the wall ends at the swoop of asphalt drive coming around from the back of the showroom. Wendell cranks the wheel and speeds toward the far end of the wall. He can still hear the motorcycles, but they sound like a distant swarm of bees. They must be about a half mile away, Wendell thinks, and jumps out of the Toyota. He jams the cassette recorder in a jacket pocket, slings the Nikon on its strap around his neck, and runs around the low wall and into the meadow. Even before he reaches the tree line, he can see the remains of an old macadam road, broken and overgrown, cutting downhill between the trees. Wendell imagines, overestimating, that Ed's old place is about a mile distant, and he wonders if his car could go the distance on this rough, uneven surface. In some places, the macadam has fissured into tectonic plates. In others, it has crumbled away to black gravel. Sinkholes and weedy rills radiate out from the thick, snaking roots of the trees. A biker could jounce over this mess reasonably well, but Wendell sees that his legs will manage the journey better than his Toyota. So he sets off down the old track through the trees. From what he took in while he was on the highway, he still has plenty of time before the medical examiner and the evidence wagon show up. Even with the help of the famous Hollywood Sawyer, the local cops are mooning around in a daze. The sound of motorcycles grows louder as Wendell picks his way along, as if the boys stopped moving in order to talk things over when they came to the far end of the old back road. That's perfect. Wendell hopes they will keep jawing until he is nearly caught up with them. He hopes they are shouting at one another and waving their fists in the air. He wants to see them crank to the gills on rage and adrenaline, plus God knows what else those savages might have in their saddlebags. Wendell would love to get a photograph of Beezer St. Pierre knocking out Dale Gilbertson's front teeth with a well-aimed right or putting the chokehold on his buddy Sawyer. The photograph Wendell wants most, however, and for the sake of which he is prepared to bribe every cop, county functionary, state official, or innocent bystander capable of holding out his hand, is a good, clean, dramatic picture of Irma Freneau's naked corpse. Preferably one that leaves no doubt about the fisherman's depredations, whatever they were. Two would be ideal, one of her face for poignancy, the other a full body shot for the perverts. But he will settle for the body shot if he has to. An image like that would go around the world, generating millions as it went. The National Enquirer alone would fork over, what, 200,000, three, for a photo of poor little Irma sprawled out in death, mutilations clearly visible. Talk about your gold mines. Talk about your big kahunas.